Hello and welcome to another episode of Medical Minds, Conversations with Guthrie Experts. My name is Steve Osterhaus and my past is in journalism. And I'm joined as always by co-host Dr. Corinne Johnston, who is a family medicine physician and chief patient experience officer with the Guthrie Clinic. Hello, Dr. Johnston. How are you?
Hi, Steve. I'm good. How are you doing?
I am doing well. Did you do anything fun this weekend?
Yeah, actually, I did. I tested out the new heated gloves that my husband got me when the family and I went skiing just in time for the cold temperatures.
Is that like those heated gloves? I don't know if you're from, they're from a way back time, but you know, kids would have them. And if you touch something cold, the gloves would change color.
Remember Ooh, I remember those. I saw them recently when I was shopping. No, these are those battery operated. So there's batteries in the glove that I charge and then the glove stays warm. I think I have every piece of clothing from this brand of heated wear.
Nice. Yes. It is certainly very, very cold. Our topic, as people hear in just a couple of minutes, is very timely, as is our word of the day. And I believe it's pronounced frigophobia. Does that sound
frigophobia,
right?
Frigophobia. Could be either way. We're not sure. Tomato, tomato.
Yeah, right. And is that the fear of cold?
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you have any wordsmiths amongst us, right, break it down. Frigus, frigus is Latin for cold. And phobia is a fear, right, in an intense, sometimes illogical fear. So fear of cold.
Right. And I was looking at some of the definition as well, and not just the fear of cold as we're thinking of it as temperatures, but I also saw that it can be fear of even something like cold food, even something along those lines. And if you ask my family, while I am not diagnosed with this, I like my food very hot.
Okay.
So even after, like, you know, we'll be cooking something, we'll be getting dinner ready, and then as we're all putting it on our plates, I'm always usually one who then goes back and throws it in the microwave too again, because I need like scalding hot food when I sit down at the table.
Yeah. So Steve, no diagnoses on these podcasts, but it sounds like it might fit.
maybe just a little bit.
Well, Steve, joining us today as our guest on our podcast is someone who probably can shine some light on frigophobia, or maybe she has it. I don't know. We can ask her. We have Dr. Katie Lincoln with us today. Katie did a residency training in family medicine and then specialized in wound care. So she is someone that primary care often interacts with and someone that can really give us a lot of guidance on what we need to do with wounds, when to seek care, and how to prevent getting them. Katie, welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to doing this for weeks since you asked me. So I'm thankful to be here. And Steve, thank you so much for making this possible for the viewing audience.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And we are ecstatic to have you joining us. And the timing is perfect. As you said, we've been talking about this for a while, but the temperatures, at least in the area we're in the Northeast, have certainly started to dip. So I guess let's start, if you could talk about, in terms of prevention and protection and ways that we can avoid, even though we do have a lot of outdoor enthusiasts here in this region, how we can avoid getting hit a little bit too hard by the cold.
We worry about frostbite. So frostbite at its essence is an injury to the skin caused by cold. Sometimes we think about heat burns, being burned by small space heaters and things like that, but cold can be just as dangerous. And I think sometimes we forget to worry about that in our list of worries. When we start to get damaged, the trouble with cold burn is that you get the initial injury, which stuns the cells and can kill them, but then your rewarming can additionally injure. And so I think it's important to know about frostbite, there's sort of two waves of things to worry about, is that initial injury, and then when you come back into the warm. And that was something I really didn't know or consider until I was thinking about this recently with the Arctic temperatures that we've been having.
Mm-hmm. So sometimes you might think, oh, my finger got so cold because my glove had a hole in it. And then I come inside and it hasn't fallen off. So I'm probably okay, but maybe I'm not.
Well, and so you actually can't tell the extent of a frostbite injury until that limb is rewarmed. And so you can't look at something. It all sort of looks a little discolored, sometimes white, sometimes dark. You can't tell the extent of the injury until you're rewarmed. And so, you know, if a day has gone by and you're back to baseline temperature, you will be able to see a difference. We know that you're rewarmed, that that limb is rewarmed when that place that you're worried about is pink or purple. That lets us know that you're back to the temperature. And it lets us know the area of concern. And so there what used to be a grading system, and that grading system has changed. So if you go to your primary care doc or you end up in the emergency room for cold-related injury, the first concern is where in your fingers or feet is the biggest area of concern. Is it just your very end of your fingertips, or is it to your digits here? Is it up to here? And the further up it is and the more severe it is, really is a risk for having amputation, loss of limb. If at 24 hours, which is about when you're going to know if everything is okay or not, if there's just a little bit of purplish discoloration in the fingertips, that's an excellent sign that things are going to be okay. If you really have at 24 hours, 72 hours, have significant discoloration up into the hands, it's very worrisome. But there really is this area of rewarming. Something I learned in preparation for this interview today was that we live in a place where people hunt and people go to their tree blinds and they're out in the cold. I mean, it's 0 degrees out, you know, feels like zero today. And people are outside, they're skiing, they're cross-country skiing, they're snowshoeing, and they really are exposed to the elements for significant amounts of time. What we worry about is when you come back in to make sure that you get all of your wet items off of your body, or if you find someone who is unconscious and outside, that you get their wet clothes off.
Okay.
The thing that I learned the most this week is that you shouldn't rewarm someone until they're at their final destination for rewarming. So if you find someone and you put them in the car, don't put them on full blast heat until they're in the emergency room. What we don't want is a freeze thaw freeze. We don't want them back out in the elements after they've had a pretty significant thermal burn.
I'm learning a ton in just the last 2 or 3 minutes, because I would have been that person who would have assumed, oh my gosh, just heat them up as soon as possible, get them to, you know, warmer temperatures. So that's really surprising to me, but really educational, I think, for our listeners.
Well, and that's, so we want to do sort of a terminal thaw when they're at the place that they're going to stay, whether that's in a home setting, whether that's at the cabin where they're staying for skiing. And some ways when you're out on the ski slopes and you're really starting to worry, you're having some numbness and tingling, especially in your fingertips. If there is no immediate way to get warm, the first thing to do is get the wet things off. And then there's body places on your own body that you can warm up your fingertips, to include your armpits and your groin. And they really will help to preserve your fingers. We all really like having distal fingertips. They're not necessary for life, but we really like having them. As a person who types charts often, I really like having distal fingertips. And so something that you can do if you're in a place where you're not able to rewarm is to stick those fingers in there to keep them attached.
Yeah. I'm reminded of very, very Corinne, in a Corinne way, I'm reminded of Mary Catherine Gallagher, if you're an old SNL fan, like superstar. So if it's really cold and I can't get them warm, I need to be Mary Catherine Gallagher. Okay.
Well, and so what I learned, our friends here love sous vide, this warming thing where you can reheat meat very slowly at a constant temperature. You submerge your meat. We have a friend who talks about sous vide all the time. And in my research about cold-related injury, if you're in a place where going to your primary care physician or going to the emergency room is not possible, or you're choosing not to go, you can warm your sous vide water bath, whirlpool bath up to between 98 degrees and 102.2 degrees. You can actually set your sous vide, and then you can put either your feet or your fingertips into your sous vide whirlpool bath. Again, this is for those who are choosing not to seek medical care, but it's something that'll rewarm slowly so that you don't injure. We never want to stick digits under piping hot water, because you can't feel during that time of rewarming. So you could really cause a secondary injury.
Oh, so another burn.
Yeah, I'm guessing that was not in the marketing materials for that product when they put it out there.
I do not think it was in the package insert, but I read it and I was delighted and I stopped what I was doing to text my friend who talks all the time about the magic of sous vide to let him know, as the hunter, I have a secondary use for this.
Yeah. And I think some of that's pretty important, right? You know, we keep talking about, like, if you're hunting or you're skiing, you know, the first case of frostbite I saw clinically was someone who went out to shovel the snow and had on some shoes that the soles were cracked. And so came in with these spots on their foot several days later. And I said, gosh, I think that's frostbite. So you don't have to be the person lost on the mountain, Katie, to get frostbite.
Well, and so when I was reading about who are most likely to be exposed to frostbite, the point that was made in the research was that it's oftentimes people who are making decisions that they may not otherwise make. So people in mental health crisis who are outside, who are not taking in the elements as I might, who are not in a place that to make sort of a linear decision of, if I stay outside and don't have shoes on, I'm going to cause harm to myself. People that are just in a place where they're not processing that information. People who are using drugs and alcohol, and so the substances are altering their perception of harm or potential harm. You know, in my life, I'm a fully grown adult over the age of 21. I have consumed a beverage. And sometimes you think that you can walk a lot further home to a safe place than you can. And it gets very cold out and you're blunted from the effect of that. And so it can be deadly when you're in a place where you're altered either because of something that you chose to consume or from a mental health problem, you know, dementia. Somebody gets out of their house and they start wandering around. They're just not able to assess their risk factors. And so when we talk about prevention, we talk about not ingesting substances in a way that's unsafe. I mean, that should sort of be a global wound care avoidance technique, is be very aware of the substances that you're ingesting and how they're going to affect your skin and body. But having a plan, I think the most important part of prevention is, if you're going to be on the mountain, how often are you going to check your skin? If you're going to be out hunting, how often are you going to take a break? Do you have a warm place that you can rewarm and take your wet things off? If you're going to consume alcohol, how are you going to get home without walking home? You know, it's like all things in primary care. You want to avoid the things you can avoid. And there are some things that just are.
A couple of things jumped out at me. I am also an adult over the age of 21. So may or may not have consumed an alcoholic beverage. But, you know, the kind of the joke at that age is, oh, that'll warm you up, you know, but it's actually the opposite, right?
Right. Well, and so frostbite injury and cold related injury won't kill you. It will make you lose your digits, but it won't kill you. The thing that kills you is hypothermia, the falling asleep in the snow and your core body temperature dropping, the not being aware that you're having a heart attack. Those are the things that will kill you. Frostbite injury will nip away at your limbs and deform you, but it won't kill you. So when you find a person that's down, unresponsive in a snowbank, you know, there's sort of a glib saying in the medical field that you're not dead until you're warm and dead. But that's true. The person won't die of frostbite. They'll die from hypothermia. And so we need to bring them to a rewarming place and then reassess them.
Along those same lines, so you had mentioned, you know, if you're out on the slopes and you want to maybe check your skin regularly, and, you know, there's discoloration, but you said you don't really know perhaps until 24 hours or so later whether or not you really have an injury that you need to take care of. So it is possible then to be experiencing frostbite but not even realizing it?
Yeah. So usually people notice numbness in the fingers and toes. So if you go to your rewarming station, many people here ski at Greek Peak. So you go to Greek Peak, you eat your lunch. By the time you've eaten your lunch, you should be able to feel all the parts of your body. And if there's a part where you're like, this doesn't feel safe, or my gloves are soaking wet, that's no longer a safe environment for you. And you should cut your day short. Some of the literature that I read that I found fascinating was, once you've had a cold related injury, you should not be exposed to cold for 6 months. So those of us who live here in the North, I don't logistically know how you would just, I would love to avoid the cold for the next 6 months. But if you've had, you know, you're seeking medical care, You know, you're being watched for blisters. People always ask, should we pop blisters if they come up from frostbite? And that's always a discussion. That's a discussion with your primary care team. The skin is the largest organ. So if you take an intact blister and you start cutting it open, now the outside world can get in there and give us things, you know, cellulitis and other infections that are sometimes grave. So we like to leave intact skin intact, but you need to use a little bit of common sense. And if you come in, you have your period of rewarming while you're eating your cheeseburger at Greek Peak, and you still are having numbness and tingling in your fingers or toes, you really should call it a day. And the hunters too. Sometimes the hunters will take these small, you know, plug-in heaters or battery-powered heaters, and they'll take them into their blinds or into their tree stands. The population that I serve often is diabetic and doesn't perceive heat or cold like other people. They have some nerve damage from their diabetes. And so it is not infrequent in my practice that someone will sit in a deer stand and they'll turn their little space heater on. They can't feel the burn. And so they, by the end of the day, when they take all their stuff off at home, they find a very large heater burn because that hot has been blowing on them all afternoon and they just didn't perceive that threat.
Yeah. I was, Katie, when Steve and I did our intro, we were talking about that. And I talked about how I tried out my new gloves that are heated that my husband got me for Christmas. So I think that's a great point in, you know, I can feel, but if I don't have great feeling in my hand and I put that on, what I can do. And we see that with heating pads, right? Like I fell asleep on my heating pad and burned myself.
And you can really get a bad, bad blister from heating burns. You know, our bodies are incredible and we're able to regenerate in so many ways. But when we have diseases, sometimes of age, these chronic diseases that take away our ability to feel, and in particular pain, whether it's hot pain or cold pain. You know, if I have a blister that I rub on my foot from wearing stupid shoes, I'm going to complain and crab about it all day. There is this wonderful wound care professor that says the gift of pain. And so when you can't feel pain, you don't have that gift of pain anymore. You stay out longer than you should hunting, skiing, and doing these things. And you just don't know the extent of your injury until you're back inside. I will say something else that I learned that this is fact with Dr. Lincoln today. There was a study in Norway. And so when I was a little kid in upstate New York, it was an old wives' tale that if you covered your face in Vaseline, that it would protect your skin from windburn. Mm-hmm. So when we were going to go ski, and it's always, you know, -5 with the wind chill, that if you put Vaseline on your skin, it would actually give you like an extra coating. So they did this study in Norway and actually found that that just conducts the cold more.
Oh, no.
And it is absolutely a recommendation not to do that. Read it and I'm like, I've done that. I did that a ton as a kid. And it sort of makes sense. I mean, if you want to add moisture to your hands when they're dry and cracked and you cover them in Vaseline, why not do that to your face so that the wind can't get to your skin? Turns out that does not work. So don't do that.
So how do we get kids to wear coats in the winter? If you can answer that
question. Excellent question. What is the answer? Bribery? I am a very big fan of parental bribery.
Yes.
I mean, also natural consequences. Like kids, unlike, they're probably not taking life-altering substances or mood-altering substances. At some point, they're going to get cold. And I don't know that anything makes me more mad as a parent than when I say, you're going to need a jacket. It's cold. You're going to need a jacket. And then we get to the place and I have worn my jacket. And one of my children said, I'm very cold. Can I have your jacket? I'm like, I told you. But
we are always right. That's the bottom line.
Listen, I know. Why don't you tell them? But it really is important. I think there's a certain point in your adult life where you're like, oh, shoot, I really do need a hat and gloves. And I will feel much more cozy in a hat and gloves, even though it's not the cool thing to do.
I'm not going to lie. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, please.
I've woken up on a few occasions when I know I need to do some shoveling from a snowfall the night before, and I've still got the pajamas on, you know, and I'll just shuffle out there real quick and shovel a pathway and things like that.
That's not a problem. That's a primary layer. As long as you put a coat over it, it's fine.
Yep.
I did too learn that mittens are better for protection than gloves. So when we were skiers, as young people who didn't worry about breaking all of their limbs at the same time, we would always use gloves because they were easier for the poles. But yeah. The research around cold-induced injury says that mittens, because your fingers are staying together, is actually better for frostbite prevention. So if you want to be a good skier, gloves. If you want to be a good person with all of their digits, all of the whole digits, mittens.
That kind of makes sense, right? Because if you said, you know, if you want to stick your hands and fingers in your armpits, things like that, so you're putting them with, that makes some sense. I wouldn't have thought of it, but.
Steve, I thought you might were maybe going for Naked and Afraid, right? So if you've watched Naked and Afraid, they're freezing. They have to cuddle while they're naked so that they can stay warm. So, and I think sometimes when you watch those like documentaries on people that get stuck on, you know, Mount Kilimanjaro or where not, they're stuck in a tent together and they tell them, right, they have to share body heat.
That's not where I was going at all.
Sort of intuit that. So, right? Our bodies cast off so much heat.
Yeah.
But I would hope that if you're stuck in the middle of the Adirondacks and all you have is body heat, great. I would hope that if someone was altered and someone was not altered, the person who was thinking we should cuddle should call for help instead of cuddling. Like, that would be my preference if I'm going to go one way or the other.
That might be our tagline like for this one. Call for help before cuddling. So let's say we've done that, right? So we called for help. We slowly rewarmed in our terminal place. They come see me. I say, wow, this is a pretty gnarly wound. I don't think it's going to heal on its own. I send him to you, Katie. What's next?
Well, I mean, from my side, I'm going to just assess, do they have intact skin or not intact skin? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of blistering. There have been patients this winter who have ended up in the hospital from thermal-related injuries in this way. And there is no good studies to say, we left this person out in the cold, we let them blister, and then this guy we cut open and IND'd all of the blisters, and this guy we left them intact. We just don't have data to support that. It really involves what resources the patient has. Do they have a family doctor that they can follow up with? It is important just to remember that we don't know what the extent of the injury until 24, 48 hours out. So somebody may come into primary care and say, this just happened. I woke up like this. I was altered last night being over the age of 21. I woke up in a place that was cold and now my mom is going to be mad at me if I lose all my digits. And they come in to see you at the 8 o'clock spot. It's difficult for you to know, impossible for you to know what that wound is going to look like at 24, 48 hours. So that's definitely somebody that you would want to say, okay, stay in a warm place. No additional cold thermal injuries, you know, stay in your bed after rewarming. I need to see you back tomorrow morning first thing.
Yeah.
How honest are those patients with you, generally speaking? So are some people a little bit worried about telling the whole truth?
Really amazing. No, people tell me all sorts of crazy things that they've done. So I love Judge Judy. And I think that she's a very interesting person as an interviewer, because she'll listen to the whole story and then she'll go, tell me about that one thing that you said that didn't make any sense. And she's able to like wormhole into the truth. And so sometimes when people present to care, they go, I'm here because my hand hurts. And you go, okay. And they are put into a room, hand hurts. Oh, let's get an x-ray. Well, okay. Tell me why your hand hurts. Well, I was walking the dog and my hand got yanked. Okay, tell me more. And well, I may or may not have been using substance not otherwise specified, which left me altered. This actually happened 3 days ago. And so the more you ask questions and the more you're just open, I see all patients from all walks of life. And if I come in angry, hurried, motherly, sometimes I'm not going to get the story. But if I listen, I have literally heard anything that you can create. I'm already there. Like, tell me what actually happened so I can help you. I think attitude has a lot to do with it. You know, if you're open and say, I'm not here to judge. What is the thing that's viral right now? I'm not here to judge, whatever it's called.
Hear me out.
No, there's like a viral, like cool thing right now. That's like, we listen and we don't judge. That's what it's called.
Oh, that, yep.
And they're like these little shorts where people like tell you their most awful truth And it's meant to be very funny. But people like that, I'm like, listen, just tell me what happened. I'm not here to judge you. I just want to make you feel better. I'm not here to tell your mom. I'm not here. You know, oftentimes I see patients that are a little bit older who also do dumb things occasionally. And I'm like, listen, I'm not here to rat you out to your grandkid who's your caregiver. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure you're okay. Yeah. And so I think all things in healthcare, when you have an established relationship, when you can lead with kindness and just say, listen, I'm an expert of the skin. I don't know why you made a bad decision, but I do know about skin. So help me to help you, you know, get to the right person, the right place. If you lead off with, why did you do something so dumb? You're never going to get the whole story.
No. And, you know, one of my mentors once said, if you ask the right questions, the patient will tell you what's wrong with them. Right. It's about us sometimes too, asking the right questions or inquiring or removing that judgment.
That's why our medical education is so long, because sometimes I can look at a burn and say, the story that you're telling me and what I am seeing is not in line with what I've seen with your story before.
Yeah.
What I've seen this to look like before is someone who was in a deer blind and their wife called and told them to come home and they didn't, and they got a burn, which is a different story than you're telling me. But the thing I'm seeing looks like the thing I've seen before. And sometimes you can, you know, find some common ground and open up that true story.
Yeah.
So once you're able to, the patient's gone the 24, 48 hours, you're starting to get a better look at what the problem is and the severity of it. What does it look like down the road in terms of recovery/treatment? And I'm sure it's going to be different depending on how severe.
So if you're just looking at very distal fingertips, rewarming, not much to do, even stage two, which is sort of into this joint here, maybe very purple, maybe very painful. In people that can take over-the-counter medications like Tylenol and Motrin, they should do that for pain relief. They may get blisters, which we would prefer to leave intact. And it may be very painful. Your body is reacting to that rewarming, so you're getting cell death. It may be very painful, but mostly it's fine. When we start getting into grade 3 and 4, which is true tissue necrosis further down, further up, with equivalence on the hands and feet, is when we really say you need to come into the hospital, you need to have a full assessment. There are medications if the arteries have been clamped down because of the cold. There are medications that they can use here in the hospital setting. There's some advanced imaging you may need for those very severe limb-threatening injuries, but that's not the most of the cases. Most of the people are waking up and saying, uh-oh, I think I may have hurt myself.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense because, you know, at least when I was a kid, I remember very specifically, whether it be my mom or my friend's parents, always putting out the threat of, you don't want to get frostbite. You know what I mean? And so I don't even know if I could tell you what it looked like at the time, but I just knew I don't want to get frostbite, whatever it is, this horrible, creepy, scary thing. So I would always bundle up.
You must wear a hat.
Yes.
Yeah.
Still true. I still am yelling at the kids. I would just like them to wear a coat.
Yeah. And it's, some of this is similar, right? There's this process, which Steve, do you know what Raynaud's is? Have you heard of that?
I'm not incredibly familiar with it, but yes, it's in terms of the cold fingers and hands, right? And extremities.
Yeah. So that can even lead in some folks to a frostbite-like injury, right? So there's the blood vessels spasm. Katie,
well, and you can actually get crossover with people with Raynaud's that get frostbite. It is a risk factor, peripheral vascular disease of all kinds, from diabetes, people with significant heart disease, their blood flow to their feet is probably not ideal. So anybody whose blood flow isn't optimized, people with diabetes, we already talked about, people with mental health crisis, hypothyroid, sometimes those folks have some numbness and tingling in their distal fingers. If they already are hypothyroid and untreated, they're more likely to get frostbite injury that needs care, needs medical intervention.
If you were to tell, I mean, you've been giving tons of advice, but if there's the one thing that you would tell people, what would it be to prevent yourself from having from having this horrible injury?
Prevention. I mean, prevention is always the name of the game. So having self-awareness for risk factors to say, if I'm going to drink alcohol, how am I going to get home? If I'm going to go out and snowshoe, I just got snowshoes for Christmas that I haven't used yet. If I'm going to go out, where am I going to stop? How far out am I going to get before I can come back and reassess? To know where your safe spaces are, to know where your remote warming spots are. Hunters, if there's a restaurant or a bar on their path where they can stop, rewarm, check their feet, make sure their socks are not wet. Dress in layers, always dress in layers so that you can pull those layers off. The layer closest to your body should always be a wicking material so that as you sweat, because if you're moving around in the cold, you're probably sweating. You need to be warm. You need to have those layers of insulation that you can peel off, but also put back on. But I would say just have a plan for whatever you're going to do. You know, people go to the Himalayas. Some of those folks get frostbite, but creating a plan, having a spare set of gloves so that when your gloves get wet, you've got something dry to put on. Just thinking through, I mean, in medicine, before we go in to do a procedure, we always want to think, what are the potential outcomes? What are the complications? Am I going to need a stitch? You know, is the patient on a blood thinner? Before you do anything, before you leave the house every day, you should say, do I have enough gas in the car? And you sort of pre-plan your life. If you're going to be at risk for cold-related injury, having a plan and just thinking through, this is where I'm going, this is what I'm going to do, this is how I'm going to keep myself safe, and certainly the, you know, dependents, whoever your animals and children are that are with you, creating a plan for them as well.
A great point. Not only our kids we can threaten, bribe, whatever parenting style we choose. Our pets, they don't have a choice, right? So keeping them protected.
Well, my fluffy little 7-pound dog does not like to go outside and go to the bathroom when it's 0.0 degrees outside right now, but that's where it happens. So being able to wipe his paws off when he comes in the house, to get the wet off of him. He's got a absolutely ridiculous little fluffy jacket we put on him if we're going to take a walk anyplace. You know, when we're out in the cold rain, he's got a raincoat, which is absurd. And I realize that it's absurd, but I don't want him to lose his little puppy toes.
Our 7-pound dog, we have one as well. He sometimes gets dressed up. My wife has put a few sweaters on him here or there, which is great. I may joke around about it, but I understand it's the right thing to do. But I am selfish about it though, because I kind of enjoy the cold weather is kind of good for that, because then he hurries up a little bit when he's outside. Yeah. Gets in quickly.
Excellent point.
We're talking about wounds specific to cold weather, but can you talk a little bit more about wound care in general? Because I think some of our listeners and viewers would be interested to know, you know, if you see someone in a hospital or in a clinic, the thought may be, oh, that person is sick or has an injury, and so their wound has to heal. But I think until I started working in the healthcare industry, I didn't understand that there were specific people dealing with wound care as opposed to a doctor who helps with wounds, if that makes any sense.
So I'm a wound care expert. I see patients in the office and in the hospital, and all I see is wounds all day long. And it's been the joy of my life to do this work because of what you said. People don't really know that that's a job. It's a beautiful job that I love because it really is the intersection of medicine and surgery. So we do a lot of surgical procedures, skin substitute therapy, hyperbaric oxygen therapy, all these things to help the patients to get better. But at the same time, having a continuous relationship with them every week or every other week, taking care of them and getting them better with their wound, sort of incrementally, step by step. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful part of medicine because when they come to me, they have a specific problem. Unlike primary care, where your one-stop shop doc fixes your diabetes, your mental health problems, your toenail fungus, and lets you cry on their shoulder when your kids are misbehaving, the patients come to me because they have a wound. And so we try to figure out what kind of wound it is, do biopsies if it's unclear at that time, and then based on the type of wound that they have, optimize all of the things, get the diabetes under better control, venous ulcers, making sure the patients get compression therapy so that that venous ulcer can heal up. People who have pressure injuries or pressure ulcer, used to be called decubitus ulcers, that we give them support services to be able to get them off of their wounds. So figuring out what they have and then fixing the problem that they have and working on a team. We have a wonderful multidisciplinary team here in the office. Our nurses are specialists of wound. That's all they do all day long. And so it really is a collaborative team effort with primary care first and foremost, the endocrinologists, the surgeons, the trauma surgeons. We work in a wonderful institution here at Robert Packer Hospital where the trauma surgeons are just down the hallway. So occasionally they'll say, this person has this really big, bad thing. They are happy to take care of them while they're in the hospital. And then when they're transitioning out to the world and back to their life, they may still have a really big wound from that surgery or from a cancer. So we're happy to take those people. And then we follow them every week or every other week until it's better. And hopefully that is 3 months, 4 months, but sometimes it's a year and a half. Sometimes it's 2 years. And so it really is it's a continuity relationship where every time the patient's in, they're not saying, I'm the lady that got bit by the raccoon and then had to have plastic surgery. We know who they are. I know who they are. And so it really is a wonderful blend of surgery techniques with that very continuous understanding who lives in their household, what drives them. They want to get better so they can go to their grandkids' soccer game. And really understanding what's important to the patient. I have someone that's very dear to me that I see as a patient who has smoking-related disease. And I still say, like, you know, this is driven by the smoking. And they're like, yeah, but I'm not going to quit. Okay, well, then I'll see you next week. And sort of meeting people where they're at. It's the same thing with cold-related injury. Meeting people where they're at, just saying, I want to help you. No matter what that looks like, I want to be here to help you. But we have a wonderful opportunity here because we get to train nursing students at all various levels, nurses that are inpatient, nurses that are home health nurses that are seeing these patients out in their homes. We have medical students who spend their whole year here, not here, thankfully. That would be a lot. we have family medicine, internal medicine. And so trying to give these people knowledge so that when they're out in their various communities that they're going to serve, they know what a wound care doctor is, what we're doing, how we're doing it. And then, you know, if they need us to be able to get a hold of us. Yeah. But it is a super weird thing that nobody knows anything about, which is why I like it.
So if you had, and this is, I'll preface this with, I've said, I think on the podcast before, that the first thing the dean of students in my medical school taught me is if someone asks you a question, you can always say it depends, because there's that much variability in what we do. But, you know, you and I have shared some patients that I can remember, just crazy, right? I call you up, Katie, this guy, I can see his skull, you know, or I can, they've had this wound on their leg for 6 months. So if I'm at home and I have some sort of wound, whether I cut myself, it just opened on its own, you know, obviously 6 months is too long. But when do I start to say, I need to go get medical care? Like, I need to go see someone. This is not healing. It's been X amount of time.
Yeah. So we always want to look at the patient. There's this silly saying, you want to look at the hole in the patient and then you want to look at the whole patient. So good. If it's an 18-year-old healthy athlete who banged their shin, odds are that they're going to be fine. They could put dirt in it. I mean, don't put the little disclaimer under this. Do not put dirt in your wound. But we moved here from Texas and there were people that caliche is this very mineral rich dirt. So people would put it in their wounds all the time. Anyway. So when you're looking at the patient, is it someone who's undergoing chemotherapy? Is it someone who's institutionalized and isn't able to choose what rainbow of foods they're eating? Is it someone who has had a surgery and unable to take in a certain number of calories and protein? You have to look at the human that the hole is in. And then when you look at the hole, patients with diabetes have a difficult time healing. So the better control they're in, the better we're going to do. But if you are a diabetic, it puts you at much higher risk. So if you're a diabetic and you're worried, you should talk to your family doctor. Yeah. All of us as human beings get injuries. We kick the dog in the middle of the night. We hit the washing machine crossbar every time. I don't know why. We have surgery, we have C-sections. Like, as human beings, we get our gallbladders out. Not everyone should end up in a wound care center. So if you have any sort of cut, abrasion, from whatever. It doesn't actually matter what the trauma was in the beginning. If it's been 21 days and you've had to either go to the Walmart and buy everything on the wound care shelf, or you've had to see your doc more than once for your concern, you probably should talk to your family doc about, do you need a wound care center? So 21 days, we should be able to heal up our C-section, bang your shin on the car door, get scratched outside, you know, a dog bite, a dog scratch. I wouldn't say a dog bite, that's a different category, but we really should be able to overcome with very little intervention. So if you're finding like, oh, I got the wound wash with the blue label, and then I got some of this magic potion, and my neighbor at the garage told me to use this kind of soap. Like, if you're having that many inputs, something is probably up that you should seek care for.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Lincoln, you have been a wealth of knowledge and information and an absolute joy to talk to. So thank you so much for being a part of this with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's always a joy to see you.
Well, she was fantastic.
Fantastic. And a lot of information there, right, Steve?
Yes.
So much to take, but really kind of hitting on the same topics. You know, I think of the podcasts that we've done so far. So Dr. Sampson, right, talking about strokes, but really talking about things that decrease blood supply,
right,
how that runs into, you know, healing of a wound or of frostbite, how that runs into, you know, do I go to the ER or do I go to my primary care doctors? Like, I think there's a great, great story being told here. And,
yes,
you know, we often forget in medicine that it starts with prevention.
Yep. Absolutely.
And as a society, right, we want the fix now. We don't want to put the work in sometimes ahead of time.
Yes, I am definitely somebody who has maybe fallen victim to that, not wanting to put the work in and then just wanting it fixed in the end.
For all of us, the first step is admitting it. We're all there.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm assuming, because you said that you got the new gloves for Christmas, so you are a skier then.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you're an outdoor enthusiast, which makes sense for the region that we live in. I have never been an outdoor enthusiast, so I guess I'm one of the lucky ones that doesn't need to go outside in the cold too much. I mean, I like the outdoors. Yeah. I don't like to hide inside, but mm-hmm. I remember going skiing. I've only been skiing 2 or 3 times, and it was on the smallest bunny hills and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And I remember I couldn't figure out how to stop. So my way of stopping was purposely falling.
Yeah.
And so I would fall, and I think I looked like in a cartoon where you're just rolling down the hill and the skis are going every which direction in the snow pile. And one of the people on the ski patrol at the bottom of the hill is like, oh, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, I did it on purpose. It's the only way I know how to stop, you know? So that's me when it comes to outdoor activities.
You know, sometimes it's when we start it, right? I was 5 years old and my parents threw me out. If 30-year-old Corinne had to learn to ski, I probably never would, because I'd be so afraid of falling in the cold and all of the things. But
yes, I think growing up in this area, I definitely do wish that I would have gotten into skiing a little bit earlier, because I think I would have enjoyed it. I mean, it is fun. I just was sore afterward because I knew I had to stop that way.
Yeah. Soreness follows us, right?
Yes.
With every year.
All right. Well, we hope everyone listening and watching who does enjoy the outdoors, we hope you get that great opportunity throughout the rest of the winter to take advantage of some of that white stuff. If you'd like to listen to this podcast again or any of our other episodes, be sure to check out Guthrie Engage. That's guthrie.org/engage. And you can check out all of our episodes. Or, of course, you can go wherever you find your favorite podcast, whether it be Spotify, Apple, or our YouTube channel. We encourage you to do that. And our Guthrie Engage website will also just give you tips outside of those podcasts, tips for living a little bit healthier lifestyle. So, Dr. Johnson, as always, it was great chatting with you and our guest, Dr. Lincoln, and we'll do it again next time.
Great, Steve. Have a good one.